You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time, the
welcome to live taping of the Getting to Yes And podcast. You'd think I wouldn't trip over that because I say it every week, but I did. My guests tonight are Katie Borum-Chatou and Lauren Feldman. Katie is the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Social Impact and Assistant Professor in the School of Communications at American University. She is a former philanthropy director and producer with legendary TV producer and activist Norman Lear, program officer at the Kaiser Family Foundation's Entertainment, Media, and Public Health Program, and Senior Vice President in Social Change Communication at Global Communications Agency Fleshman Hillard. Lauren Feldman is Associate Professor in the School of Communication and Information at Rutgers University, where she studies media effects in political and science contexts. Her recent work emphasizes three primary areas of interest: media and climate change, partisan media and opinion polarization, and political satire. Her research has been supported by grants from the National Science Foundation, the Carnegie Knight Task Force on Journalism, and the Spanish Ministry of Science? Like, is that a bit or is that real?
No, that's real because I was collaborating with someone who was in Spain.
All right, pretty cool.
Sounds fun, right?
I want to be funded by the Spanish Ministry of Science. And you've been published in numerous peer-reviewed journals and edited volumes. Together, they have written a new book. It's called A Comedian and an Activist Walk into a Bar, The Serious Role of Comedy in Social Justice. It's all right. Katie and Lauren, welcome to the Second City.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm sure the combination of working at a comedy theater for my entire adult life and being married to an actual professor of comedy has me unusually focused on this topic area, but you bring up in the introduction to the book a central problem when discussing comedy. It's very hard to define. You write, quote, "To ascribe monolithic one-size-fits-all characteristics onto comedy and its ability to contribute to social change risks possible backfiring." God bless you.
Bless you.
So I'm curious, let's talk about the pitfalls first. What is hard about talking about comedy?
Well, one thing just to start off, and then we can sort of volley back and forth on this. You know, it's important when we think about our own lens, right? So Lauren and I both work in media. We study media. We produce media. You know, together we call ourselves this Venn diagram, right? So we do different things in media. So when often in the field of media and communication, when we talk about social change, it tends to occasionally be a very specific sort of precise, well, behavior change equals this thing, and if you target these audiences with these messages, this will happen. Now, we know as scholars and as media producers that that's not entirely true, and so I think that we wanted to start off the book by saying that actually we don't mean that. When we're talking about comedy, because comedy is really messy, and we wanted to honor throughout the book that comedy is an art form, and in fact it works when it's weird and sometimes unpredictable and sometimes messy, which is why we laugh. So that's just one piece, but other pitfalls
is just the subjectivity of, of comedy, right? What one person finds funny, the next person won't.
Yes.
And it makes it especially tricky.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's certainly my experience at Second City over the years was that very far left or sort of social justice audiences were often the worst for our comedy making.
Yes. So, too woke to function.
Too woke to function. Yeah, very earnest.
Yes.
And like that sort of like conservative Republican dad. Fantastic. Like just ready for anything.
Yes.
Let's let loose. I think that has changed, and my experience really changed with our mutual friends at Caring Across Generations, mm-hmm. and those social justice warriors love to laugh.
Yeah.
And so I think there's perhaps some generational change that's happened.
Yeah.
But the book, I want to present the central argument because I think it's important and it frames it really nicely. You say, quote, "We argue that comedy's potential for public influence in the context of social issues is newly powerful in the digital media age." Mm-hmm. Lauren, what's new now?
Well, there are a few things new. I think the first is just the explosion of media forms, mm-hmm. And media outlets that has given a platform to voices that we didn't hear from before or were harder to get to before. So that's new. And I think what's also new in the context of social justice is the way that social movements work and build.
Mm-hmm.
And they build through a process of sharing online, on social media, and comedy can feed into that in really new and powerful ways.
I think it's really interesting in the book, you note this timeline, which it's really fascinating when you hear it or see it, hear it out loud or see it. Facebook launched in 2004 and opened to non-college audiences in 2006. YouTube launched in 2005 and Twitter in 2006. iPhones and Android phones in 2007, and Netflix moved to streaming in 2010 and Amazon in 2012.
Yeah.
I mean, that's right? That's the
it's really new.
It's very new.
Yeah.
And you quote the scholar Henry Jenkins talking about participatory culture. That's connected to this somehow, right?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the backdrop of this book is participatory culture. So Henry Jenkins is a really special scholar in our field, and I think that he was called the Marshall McLuhan of our generation. And he sort of has seen these things coming before any of us were really fully paying attention to the implications of the rise of the digital age. But when he talks about participatory culture, he was talking not just about the digital media revolution and how it would be transformed in terms of streaming, but about how the role of gatekeepers would change and how the role of organizations who could become their own media makers and distributors would change. And so we find our work, the comedy work, right in the middle of that transformation. I actually feel like we've talked about this before. I feel like our book would be quite different if we wrote it 15 years ago, because sure. participatory culture is this idea that when you have a generation of young people who have grown up as digital natives, even us as Gen Xers, we did grow up in our early adulthood in digital native waters, right? Mm-hmm. And so in that capacity, we understand that organizations have created their own work on YouTube. Comedians have come up through YouTube. And now the legacy media outlets and streaming outlets have picked up those comedy talents and moved them forward. And so Henry Jenkins is really talking about how participatory culture is a way that we enact our kind of civic practice also through how we participate in entertainment and politics. And it's kind of all the same. We make and remake and share again. And that's really participatory culture. And that's these comedians that we're writing about in our book are really native to that.
There's another term I picked up on this, Lauren, networked social movements. I believe that's Manuel Castells.
Yeah. And so this is really important to the role that comedy can play in social justice, in that movements now build and are sustained online, where people share personal stories and personal connections to the issues that they care about. Mm-hmm. And people are able to connect with people all over the world that care about the same things. And this is how movements get started. And comedy, particularly bite-sized comedy, mm-hmm. can be shared as part of that movement building.
It's interesting, too, to think about the idea of, like, synchrony. That the power of shared laughter in a room, mm-hmm. which is really amazing. And we know as comedy makers, like, you just the thing I love watching Second City shows be created is mm-hmm. when you know that thing is going to come where everyone's going to laugh. So I don't watch the actors on stage.
Yeah.
I watch the audience, because this like magic, we're going to make you all laugh. So what's happening at that point, right, is that Everyone is having a insight at the exact same time. Mm-hmm. And we think, when we think about social movements, right, and change, a lot of times, like the Arab Spring, right, it was like, mm-hmm. that was a plan. That was everyone at the same time having this sort of amazing moment. Yeah. So it really, you know, it has happened off stage. It happens on stage. And it's related to something, I think, that is similar to the way we receive our comedy as insight, mm-hmm. in the same way, because it's emotional, right? Comedy plays on that emotion, yeah. and these movements really need emotion. No one's going to do anything if they're detached.
Well, one thing, just to respond to that really quickly, you know, this is so key because I might have just lost my train of thought. I was so engrossed in what you were saying. When we think about, so this is kind of a sub-theme. You know, there are all these things that we're saying in the book, right? Yeah. And there are these sub-themes that really emerge in the writing of it. And the Marginalized Voices is a very big sub-theme. And one of the other sub-themes is the idea that when we think about social justice as a construct, social justice, by definition, is taking a status quo and wanting to change it, right? Mm-hmm. And wanting to literally turn it on its head. Comedy, by definition, finds a new lens into an issue. And so social justice movements, organizations, NGOs, civil society, they become somewhat calcified in what they're saying. And we know this is true. This is true in progressive movements for change that are well-meaning, but become very drumbeat, like you're supposed to do this because we want the world to be better. And at some point, people zone out, right?
Yep.
And so comedy can come in and say, wait, here's a totally different way to see it. And so it's this deviant lens. So I think we have a sentence literally in the book that says, the deviant lens of comedy is symbiotic with social justice because they're both trying to find a new lens. And so we thought, well, why? I mean, one of the sort of chief questions of the book was, if we know what we know about comedy, why is it still that we're kind of convincing well-meaning progressive social justice organizations to take comedy seriously instead of saying over and over again, like, we're a little scared, we don't know about comedy. It's like, what do you not know about? It's going to be deviant and find a new way in. And comedians are really smart, so if you mm-hmm. trust them creatively. So one theme.
I was telling you about this conversation we had with a very large tech company, and it was their inclusion folks. And when we were talking about using comedy to educate in very similar areas, by the end of the conversation, they were going, we need to play in the riskiest areas possible.
Yes.
And I'm like, you would not have heard this 10 years ago.
No.
That was not there. No. But can we do a slightly nerdy deep dive into comedy for a moment? I promise this won't go too long. But
we were afraid of this moment.
You're afraid of this moment?
With you specifically.
That's fine. I will just end up quoting my wife. Okay.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
You talk about, and this is like sort of the very early comedy, and I did double check this with my wife Ann Libra, because I was sort of like, are they right on this around the Aristotle stuff? And she went, yeah, they're right on this.
Oh my God, I'm so glad.
Deep breath.
I was like, I wanted to tell you, like, don't read the history chat. Like, we got the history right, but people didn't.
No.
Anyway.
You're okay. We double checked it. So, Aristotle's concept of comedy, quote, envisioned a mechanism that allows a culture to reflect a mirror on itself and to offer a lens for critique. Mm-hmm. That's quite simple and still true, as is a ton of stuff with that guy.
Right?
Yeah, so who did the deep dive research on this? Was both of you, or did you switch it up? What, like?
We sort of tag teamed on this one.
Yeah, because
we, you know, I was like, well, duh, Aristotle feels like the guy who should put in. Mm-hmm. And then we were like, also Freud,
right,
because they're saying similar things mm-hmm. ahead of their time, and then Simon Critchley, this other, you know, theorist. But I think the Aristotle piece and what Freud was saying too is really important. And I think sometimes, so flash forward to, you know, a gazillion years later to today, when we criticize, for example, I feel like you'll get to this, so I won't steal the thunder of the question that surely is coming about Michelle Wolff. But when we were, I know, I'm not going to tell the whole story, but when we were so quick to criticize her, but she was doing what comedy is supposed to do,
she was great.
Which is to be an absolute social critic watchdog, also on journalism. And that's okay and important. That's what comedy is meant to do. And so when we attack comedians for getting too close to the truth, we should check our own motivations on that, because going back, that was what Aristotle said. There's a societal function for that.
I don't mind jumping to this, and if we're really slick in the editing, I'll just put in the actual.
It's chapter 9.
In chapter 9, so I'm going to do that. But let me read to you a bit from her thing, because I was like, man, this is juicy. It was so good, and I watched it and loved it. So at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Michelle Wolf said, "You guys are obsessed with Trump. Did you used to date him? Because you pretend like you hate him, but I think you love him. I think what no one in this room wants to admit is that Trump has helped all of you. He couldn't sell steaks or vodka or water or college or ties or Eric, but he has helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him."
And specifically, she said, "I think you love him. Yeah. Did you used to date him?"
Very good, Michelle Wolf.
I watched it 8,000 times.
Yeah.
I thought it was so brilliant.
It is so good. So the other thing that, and this is modern comedy theorists, and many of them live in philosophy departments, so they're not funny. They talk about incongruity theory, and you talk about that as well, that becomes a big thing in comedy.
Lauren mostly wrote that.
Yeah, and right, and so one of the prominent theories to understand humor and why it's funny is this idea of incongruity, that mm-hmm. jokes bring together two disparate concepts or ideas, and they offer in that a puzzle to be solved, and that process of figuring out how these two different things go together is what ultimately makes people laugh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's also really important for all of the effects of comedy that we talk about in the book, because that mental work is how people engage with comedy and how people start to think more carefully about the issues that are embedded in the humor.
And it's mm-hmm. interesting too. This is and my wife Anne gets quoted in this book. Thank you. Good idea. But she has this idea around comedy that it begins with three elements that work together like sliders on a mixing board: recognition, pain, and distance. Mm-hmm. And recognition is the part that really is new to this field, because as many of you know too, the things we laugh at are often just things that we're like, oh, that's my husband does that. Or you see a character at the beginning of a Second City show and it comes back later in the second act of that show, and simply by them showing up in a scene, you're like, oh, that's there's something funny about that. Which doesn't contain, there's nothing incongruous about that. It's just, it's a matter of this simple thing in recognition. So, and I think one of the problems that we face, to go back to how we started this conversation, is that comedy has always been studied through this, like, other lens, but never through actually the comedy lens, like, and now we have sort of comedy crafting with people in academia, and I really applaud you for this, because this book takes comedy seriously, but not so much that it's like terrible to read. It's actually, and that's a tough blend, right? You know what I'm talking about.
That's
right?
A very high praise that our book is not terrible to read.
Yes.
Thank
well,
you.
It's the frog thing, right? It's dissecting a frog thing. Everyone's like,
so much.
Okay, I recognize that was okay.
No, but it's true. It could be terrible to read. It really could be.
So comedy is change agent. This is where we start to get into this.
Yeah.
In 2011, our friend Stephen Colbert decided to create his own super PAC, Americans for a Better Tomorrow. And I've talked to him about this. And by the way, one of the things was when they started raising real money, and I think they were up to like a million. I'm like, did you know? He's like, did not know what we were going to do with that money. So talk about how you use that as an example to sort of get into this. And so maybe tell a little bit of the story and how you see it as part of the tale in this book.
Sure. I mean, he did something really remarkable, because you take an issue like campaign finance reform and Citizens United, and people know nothing about it, and people's eyes glaze over when you start talking about it. And I use this example in my class a lot. I say, who knows anything about campaign finance reform? Who knows what a super PAC is? And they all stare blankly. Mm-hmm. And then I show them a clip from Stephen Colbert's, super PAC series, and they're like, wow, why isn't anybody talking about this, right? And so he is able to take a really esoteric, hard issue and make it digestible and make it accessible and make it funny. And research, not our research, but other great research, found that of all the kind of mainstream news sources, he's not even a news source, people learned more from his show than they did from the TV network news, from, newspapers and so forth about campaign finance reform, and it in turn shaped their views of our campaign finance system.
And he ended up donating that money, I believe, to schools, right?
To various charities, mm-hmm. some that worked on campaign finance, but also, like, a Hurricane Sandy relief.
Yeah. And, yeah, but it, like, bad. There was no plan.
No,
I mean, this
was
like,
no
it, it was just
no.
like, we're going to do this thing, which is that risk factor of comedians of like, let's just do it and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I mean, and Colbert has been, I mean, the amazing thing of, because I distinctly remember Ann and I in bed, the very first night of the Colbert Report, watching it going, this is genius. There is no way he's going to sustain this character.
Yeah.
Like, how?
Yeah.
It seems unsustainable.
Right.
And then he kept doing
like
it.
Like, you think he's going to break.
And no, I know. It's not, it's like, this crazy. Conceit you can't keep up. And then it just, like, and it's, I remember, what I love about him, too, with that character is, like, he had Tim Robbins on once, and he was like, because he's such a star fucker, that character, that it was sort of like, I disrespect you, I disrespect your beliefs. What is Clint Eastwood like? You know, like, it was just like the perfect blend.
It's awesome.
Yeah, and he would have to have these long conversations with the guests before it of like, I am going to say really ignorant, terrible things. You are invited to disabuse me of my ignorance. That's what's going on here. But not always easy for the guests to understand the game they were in.
Oh, I always wondered how he actually did that.
Yeah,
I didn't know.
That was a thing.
I always wondered, like, behind the scenes, does he make sure that they understand that
he tried to.
Wow.
Did not always
work.
Because
he's so convincing, I'm sure not everybody believed that he was really a character, right?
Yeah. The other thing, and we talked about this a little bit, but I want to talk about it more, is the sharing of comedy, which is such a beautiful, an important thing here. And you write in the book, quote, comedy connects people, and in so doing, creates the sense that they are sharing something larger than themselves. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a viral video that we're sharing, but it's the idea behind what our identity with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a shared cultural experience that is magnified when we laugh together. I mean, I think you were getting at this earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we are all laughing together at something, mm-hmm. that is the kind of connection that builds social movements, that creates collective action.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So it's mm-hmm. a form of in-grouping. So I think we can also see the dark side of this, because you know you've heard me say this phrase a million times probably, which is that, you know, it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil.
Yeah.
When Trump does his jokes.
Yeah.
You get these, right? They're all at these rallies. They're all laughing at him otherizing someone or putting someone down, right?
Yeah.
And that is the dark side. It's mm-hmm. a similar. I mean, people are just like, he's not funny. I'm like, no, he's using comedy. He is a clown.
He's a clown.
Yeah.
For sure.
So that's dark.
That's dark.
All right, we'll move on.
Yeah.
one of the things I liked about the book, again, I'm going to, like, you did a good job on your comedy stuff, because you talk about the different forms of comedy mm-hmm. and how they represent different ways into these movements.
Yeah.
So let's start with scripted. And one of the things you talk about Will and Grace, you talk about Black-ish, certain Norman Lear's work.
Yeah.
So what does scripted do in terms of the social justice context?
Well, first, I think it's important to say why Lauren and I wanted to present genres of comedy in that way, because in our field in communication and media, and you know, scholars have a particular lens and weigh into things, and we wanted this to be, even though we are, you know, professors who study media and communication, we wanted this to be as multidisciplinary as it could be and draw upon lots of different areas of work. But there's so much research in our field that focuses on satire,
mm-hmm.
on satire and news. I mean, it is really, really dominant. And so we really wanted to present, and you know, and actually when people engage in conversation, they'd say, oh, so you're just talking about The Daily Show and whatever. Actually, no, we're talking about lots of different other forms of comedy. So with scripted in particular, one of the things that we talk about is the, it's not so much because it's scripted or not scripted, but is an episodic relationship that you can develop with characters mm-hmm. over time. And that's the real meaning of when we think about the sitcom, you know, characters you experience week after week after week. And so we talk a little bit about transportation into stories and connection with characters. And there's some really beautiful research, not ours, but we cite many, many people's research in this book, which is something that we were doing very specifically to pull it all together in one place, because you can't otherwise find it. But some really beautiful research that shows that for groups who are sort of historically marginalized and othered, like in this case of the Schiappa research, the LGBT characters, mm-hmm. people who have the least exposure to those characters, to those people in real life, are the most impacted by experiencing them through mediated portrayals and specifically through comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really beautiful way to look at just allowing these characters into your world in a way through parasocial relationships that actually feels very it feels safe for people,
sure.
perhaps. And we talk about research about Will and Grace, and, you know, certainly there's a lot of anecdotal research that looks at, or anecdotal examinations that look at the possible influence of shows like Modern Family on how we felt about gay marriage, because those characters
that changed.
Were in our
I
lives.
Mean, gay marriage, like, yeah. this was this, you know, a sea yeah. change, but it, these yeah. shows were on air.
Yeah, so just to sort of bring that back to our central thesis about social justice, because the entertainment industry is in such a massive state of transformation. I mean, the advent of the streamers is really only 6-7 years mm-hmm. old, and for them to be so dominant, and they are just voraciously creating television content, yeah. and they have, you know, they know that they have to appeal to diverse audiences, and they have to pay attention, and so there is this flood of new programming that's really dealing with previously marginalized people that are really telling their truths in comedic, funny ways, and so it's just kind of converged. The entertainment marketplace has opened and created a space, and so we know, you know, through research ours and others that we cite, that this is really meaningful over time because we get to experience these characters.
So, Lauren, one of the places that where we're seeing actually marginalized voices is Netflix stand-up specials.
Yeah.
Right? So that's yeah. and the stand-up thing's different than yeah. the sitcom, right?
Totally.
Right. The stand-up thing is different for two main reasons. One, because they're even when stand-up isn't autobiographical, it comes off as
yeah.
autobiographical. Yeah. And so you feel, the audience feels as if they have this window into the comic.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. that creates a really powerful connection.
Mm-hmm.
And the other way that stand-up is different is because of the presence of the audience, even mm-hmm. in these mediated forms. Mm-hmm. There's an audience there, you know, mm-hmm. the Netflix specials. And so the other people watching at home see that connection between the comic and the audience, which also can be quite powerful.
Anne Libra has a phrase around this where she talks about stand-up comics who do perspective giving. Mm-hmm. So they are teaching the audience
yeah.
to understand them, yeah. which makes sense in this context
yeah.
of, like, seeing someone not as an other, but seeing them as having, she talks about it, seeing them as having a mind
yeah.
and a soul and a heart. And this, mm-hmm. again, when Trump does the sort of, you know, treating people as animals or, mm-hmm. or dogs, like, I don't know what this is, like, this guy hates dogs. How can anyone get behind someone who hates dogs? Can
yeah.
we bet alone? Oh, not, we're not going to talk about Trump. Sorry.
Yeah, it's dark.
But that's a very interesting thing. And then you do talk about sketch comedy, and what I appreciate about that is understanding that, and I remember I took you to your first Second City show.
I could not get enough.
I know, because
I was,
you're like, this is
I
it.
Laughed and cried.
I know, because, I mean, I think the thing we talked about was, like, this is home to this kind of work.
Yeah.
I mean, the people who started
yeah.
this, and we have Katie's on the board at Cartemquin mm-hmm. Films, which started in 1966, which is a bunch of hippies in a house, just like Second City,
like
which is a bunch of hippies, you
yeah.
know, here, all
same.
Doing the same, you know, sort of yeah. same thing, and that our work in sort of sketch, and especially improv-based sketch, is allowed to be riskier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in part because it's playing in the theater and then often translates to a digital medium. So that's it. I just appreciate the fact that you acknowledged all that.
I hope we got that right.
You did.
We talked about Second City a lot in the book. Did you feel like we did it enough?
No. You did enough. I'm quoted. She's quoted. We're good. I feel good about it. You have a chapter called Can Laughter Help Save the Planet? Can it?
Yes.
All right, how?
Well, the research in that chapter has to do with climate change, right?
Yep.
And this is, and climate change is an area that I research outside of my comedy work, and so it's important to me, not only on a personal level, but also on an academic level. And climate change is an issue that is really, really hard to communicate about,
mm-hmm.
right? The issue itself is abstract, it feels distant, it's politically polarizing. The news, traditional news, does a terrible job covering it, and so people aren't as engaged with it as we would want them to be. And so comedy offers a really important way in, a way to make the issue more relatable, more front and center, and also to inject hope and optimism into an issue that can otherwise feel really scary and really overwhelming. And so we share research, our own research
mm-hmm.
in this case, in that chapter, where we find that watching Funny or Die videos about climate change can increase people's political engagement relative to a control condition, and that it works through effects on hope and through effects on enjoyment, and that's a really important takeaway from our book in general, that you know, there is this misconception that humor might not be productive for social change because it's distracting from these big serious issues. And instead we find quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. And that the reason why comedy is so productive for social change and can be so powerful is because it entertains people and because entertainment is such a powerful form of connection. And so we show that really clearly in that mm-hmm. particular chapter, that these videos are fun. They're funny. They entertain people. People enjoy them. And that creates a meaningful connection with, in this case, a big, scary, overwhelming topic. And it can be motivating.
Mm-hmm. So I was reading this chapter, and like something was gnawing at me as I was reading this. I'm like, what am I thinking? I'm like, oh, we did one of these studies. Did you know about this?
No.
So we did a study. I had to look it up because I'm like, didn't we do this? It was with the EDF, the Environmental Defense Fund, okay. and Cornell. Okay. University.
Oh. So, oh, you know what? I read that study.
You read the study? Yeah. Well, you didn't include it in the book.
Right. No, we did. We cited somewhere.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So we created three videos, all on climate change. One was knowledge-based, one was fear-based, and one was humor-based.
Oh, that's awesome.
To assess which was most effective. Yeah. And what I remember about this is, like, they never told us what happened. And then we're like, wait a sec, what happened to those videos?
Oh, that's
Adam Schreck
funny.
Was in it, so who's on the main stage right now. So is Adam doing, and it was very funny because, like, it was hard for the other ones not to be funny, like this actor, like, doing fear-based.
Because he's funny.
Because he's funny.
Oh.
So, but we did it. So I pulled a quote from the study, article on the study, which said, quote, the humor video made people laugh more, and people who found it funny were more likely to want to plan to partake in activism.
Yeah.
Recycle more and believe climate change is risky. But putting a humor spin on such weighty subject matter comes with a trade-off, that they found that watching the humor video also decreased how scared people felt and decreased how informative they thought the video was. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's complicated.
It's complicated, I think, with this stuff. Yeah.
And, and one of the things that we do in our study is we compare the funny videos to a serious news video. And we find that while the mechanism for comedy operates through hope and enjoyment, the mechanism for news operates through fear.
Yeah.
And both hope and fear in the context of climate change are motivating. And so we need messages that channel both of those things. Mm-hmm.
But this goes back to, Kelly, you started this interview with the question about why do we say it's comedy is not a monolithic force? This is what we're saying,
yeah.
right? We want to be clear that we're saying, you know, in social change and in communication, we like to say, What is the exact impact of that story? I mean, that's just not how it works, you mm-hmm. know? And so we're saying right up front, it's real messy and complicated, but just because it doesn't do all the things doesn't mean it's not worth doing the three things.
Mm-hmm.
Because comedy is certainly doing something that news and serious information will never be able to do.
Yeah.
And they're symbiotic.
Tell really quickly for people who maybe didn't see it, the John Oliver, Bill Nye story, what he did in his show.
Oh,
do you remember this?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
This is a statistically accurate climate debate, right? And so by way, you know, we all are familiar with the kind of CNN format where they pull out, you know, one person who believes in climate change, one person who doesn't, and then that acts as if climate change is up for debate, right? And so John Oliver skewered that approach on his show where he had a statistically accurate climate debate, and he had... ostensibly, you know, Bill Nye and some other guy, but then he pulled out 97 climate scientists and then three other people
awesome.
To agree with the other guy, just to show this is what a statistically representative climate debate would really look like, not that stuff that we see on cable.
That made me so happy. Oliver's so brilliant at that.
Yeah.
God, there's so much to talk about. All right, I do want to talk about the chapter where you talk about comedians and their perspective on the intersection of art and activism. And one of the people you highlight is Francesca Ramsey, mm-hmm. who is YouTube's 2011 Next Up contest for Shit White Girls Say to Black Girls, right? And what she wrote in here is, quote, I think social media has removed a lot of the gatekeepers because not everybody can move to New York or L.A., and you talked about that earlier. Because it was hard, she won this thing, and then it was hard for her to even get a gig after that, and then ended up,
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'll just start. And know, what's amazing about her, I'm working with her now on two big comedy projects that we're doing through our center. She's quite amazing, mm-hmm. gifted brain. She's such an exemplar of the kind of comedians that we're talking about in this book.
Yeah.
Also like Hasan Minhaj, which you talk about several times throughout the book, because we talk about him in the poverty chapter and... in this case, that she made that video, Shit White Girls Say to Black Girls, which is really funny. It went viral. Everybody's seen it. It has like 12 million views.
Mm-hmm.
And then MTV found her immediately.
Yeah.
Right? Or not immediately. I don't want to overstate her hard work, but now she's on an MTV show called Decoded, where she talks about racism and discrimination. She literally decodes things, and we learned that it's used as a sort of informal high school curriculum. So it's not to say that now it's important to say that the YouTube algorithm has changed quite dramatically since that day. It's harder to find comedians now, so it's hard to imagine that comedians can fully create their art. But I think what's important and why we included this as such a strong theme in the book is that, you know, in the past, the gatekeeping on the way to the commercial marketplace for comedy, and you know this, I feel ridiculous saying this to you because you're literally a comedy expert. But they would have to, you know, get on a show, get on a sitcom, and the gatekeepers were always like big Hollywood. And now you have someone like Francesca Ramsey, someone like Hasan Minhaj, who fully created his persona as a brown man in America talking about things that were going to pertain to the immigrant community in America, is what he wants to talk about. And by the time he makes it onto, you know, Netflix and The Daily Show, they want him for that. Yeah. They want him for that persona. An Indian American young comedian talking about his experience. And although this is not scientific, we have to imagine that 20 years ago, they would have wanted him to be assimilated into some other variation of himself. And so that really goes into this sort of social justice equation, is that when previously marginalized voices are able to exert their real cultural identities through comedy, that's quite meaningful. And over time, this all adds up. But I don't know if you wanted to add
No, just kind of tagging onto that, I think another really important aspect of what YouTube and social media do for comedy, and it relates back to this idea of participatory culture, is it empowers the audience. And, you know, instead of comedians having to play to the lowest common denominator as they might have to do in a nightclub, they can find and connect with a very specific audience online who then can signal, we love this stuff, we want more of it, right? And that allows them to then build an audience and make their way into the mainstream.
Well, you talk about this in the book too, the idea that we're now living in, like, niche is a good thing. And I recall, I remember having these conversations when I was a young producer and we were taking some of the early Hollywood meetings pitching TV shows. And Andrew Alexander, our owner, would say to me, he's like, just know we're late night, we're not primetime. And it's like, we're just never going to do a primetime show. Like, SCTV was weird, you know, and that, like, and that's why it's iconic. And so, but now that's like, I think, you know, Schitt's Creek is
weird
and primetimey, but you know, I say that because it's not completely,
anymore,
but it was, you know, but it's closer. And the sort of love affair we have with those kinds of shows, so that there is this real opportunity. But let's also be honest, the gatekeepers are still mostly white men.
Correct.
White straight men.
Yeah. We say that several times.
I know you do, and I know that is me. So, but I'm not guarding the gates here
anymore.
It's okay. So, yeah.
You're letting us be on your show.
Yeah, okay, right. That's something. So, you also talk about creative collaborations. I'm going to turn it over to you, right? Because I'm in this section. This is the one where we talk about the work that, like, for example, the work we did with a group called Karen Cross Generations.
Why don't you start by telling us that story, Kelly?
Okay, great. I'm so happy you invited me.
Yes.
I got a call from Adam Grant, who's a Wharton professor, who said, hey, can you meet with my friend, Ai-Jen Poo, who's moving to Chicago? She runs this organization called Caring Cross Generations, and when Adam Grant calls you, like, he's got a whole book about giving is better than taking, and it's like, I better do this or else I'm going to be the asshole in his next book. So I took this meeting, and, like, this woman could not be more awesome.
She's very awesome.
She is powerful and funny and warm and driven, and she's changing the world with other. So she's part of Supermajority with Cecile Richards and Alicia Garza.
She created Domestic Workers Alliance.
Caring Cross Generations. And so one of the things that we ended up through our conversations realizing is that the caregiving community could really be helped by improvisation. And it really, we weren't talking about comedy. We did that later with them. But it started in, you know, we ended up presenting at Aspen Ideas Festival, got Cleveland Clinic to fund a six-week program giving improv skills training to caregivers, many of whom are working with people with dementia, because like a lot of the stuff overlaps, and you know the idea of, and I remember this, I've told this story about my mom. I mean, I'm the guy who wrote the book Yes and I couldn't Yes and my mom's dementia. Mm. I blocked. I said no. Mm. And it wasn't until later when we were doing this work, I'm just like, I can't believe I did. Mm. Like I should have known, because they've done studies now with this where it's like, yes, and this reality. Who's to say this reality is it's their reality?
Yeah.
And it doesn't need to get dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, it can be a contained flight of fancy. And that's what Yes And is about. It's about mm-hmm. going to these sort of interesting, you know, mm-hmm. areas. Mm-hmm. And then that led to us actually doing a thing that we do at Second City sometimes called Brand Stage, where we brought the Caring Cross Generations people in with home caregivers and improvisers to explore what it would be like to create comic scenarios out of these very often tough topics.
Yeah.
And the response was great. Like, they wanted those stories told. And those stories don't get told. People yeah. in poverty, those stories don't get told, do they?
Right. Well, you know, what we loved about that story, and it really connects to another story that we tell in that chapter, we talk about an organization called Define American, which is trying to humanize and change the sort of pathology around narratives around immigrants and immigrant stories. And the connection between those two things, one of the things that Elizabeth Voorhees, who we interviewed for the book, who runs their creative initiative, she said, you know, we have to use comedy when we talk about undocumented stories, because the tragedy stories, people have tuned out of them. They can't do them anymore. Yep. And so we thought there was such an amazing sense of agency and efficacy that comes from training people who feel marginalized, domestic workers, caregivers, and others who feel marginalized and invisible in every facet of their lives and mm-hmm. in their work, and then to train them to tell their own funny stories has to have a lasting impact beyond how funny they actually end up being, right?
Right.
Like, who cares if they end up being comedians, but they feel this kind of civic agency. And we love that iGen told us, and we interviewed her for the book, of course, because we love her the way mm-hmm. that you do, that she said it actually helps their advocacy work on the ground. It helps them develop their ability to actually go tell their stories to policymakers. I mean, that's real civic practice. That's not just comedy is an adorable idea and maybe mm-hmm. like, let's try it out. Mm-hmm. That's real civic practice and real agency. So we love that story. And that's sort of a theme that comes out in that chapter about these collaborations, that these groups that are dealing with issues that are seemingly hopeless. We talk about Every Town for Gun Safety, which is dealing with gun violence. And they said, you know, people only pay attention to us when there's a mass shooting. How do we mobilize people? These kinds of issues that seem seemingly hopeless, they felt like comedy was a way to mobilize even their own people. So that's another part of social change that's important, right? It's not just finding people who are in the middle or finding people who don't agree with you. It's also giving power to your base, who needs mm-hmm. energy and hope and optimism to keep going. And that's, you know, a big theme that we learned through those groups.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for your Yes And stories. You have to do it. But two other things I just want to cover real quick. Lauren, 2018, Funny or Die did all these major layoffs. And Adam McKay has gone from there as well. They've dissolved yeah. that, at least the partnership. College Humor shut down. Which seems...
It's devastating.
Crazy, right?
It seems crazy.
Elon Musk stole a bunch of top talent from The Onion, and then that didn't work out. Onion's been sold a few times over the last few years.
To Univision.
Yeah. And didn't they unload it already?
I think so.
I think they did.
They didn't know what to do.
Do we just blame all this on Mark Zuckerberg and move on, or what's happening?
I think that's fine.
I asked Lauren.
That's sorry.
I knew what
sorry.
You were going to say.
That is not a scientific answer. Yes.
Yeah, not a scientific answer.
Right.
Yes. But I mean, fine. Of course, a lot of this has to do with Facebook and the other social media platforms and the lack of transparency in their algorithms, and it has created a mess. And so it's really unclear what the future will hold. But I think, you know, two optimistic takes is one is that they have, those organizations have created a model and have made comedy such an important and vibrant part of what gets shared online. And I don't think that's going away anytime
yeah.
soon.
It's a great thing.
And the second optimistic take is that comedy has always adapted.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we write about this in the book. Back in the 50s and 60s, when you know, comedy was being censored on network TV,
yeah.
and they found their way into record albums and comedy clubs,
mm-hmm.
and so comedy is, you know, not going away.
All right, so we just have to attack the Death Star at some point, which is Facebook. Which means Mark Zuckerberg is Darth
Vader. That's our next book. That's our next book.
Okay. Yeah. The last lines in the book. Come on.
Did you love it?
Yes. I mean, first of all, I always read to the end of the book because that makes the author happy because they never believe that you actually read the book.
I did not believe it till you sent me the email yesterday. I was like, oh my God, you read the last page of the book. That's
so great.
Here's
the last lines of the book. Quote, with humor, we defy the closed, limited thinking of no but, and we choose, with the optimistic, active prospect of yes and, to imagine the possibilities that open up when a comedian and an activist walk into a bar. Hey.
Well, you finally had to get to the part like, what happens when they walk into the bar? It's the title. And you're like, I'm reading the whole book and I don't ever find out.
The yes and.
You find out on the last page.
Yes, the yes and.
The yes and.
This is great.
They saved the world.
You're on the Getting the Yes And podcast. This is all good. It all comes together. Okay, who wants to start with their yes and story?
I'll start. Right, Lauren. And mine is cliche, but I will say it anyway. My yes and story is this book.
Yeah.
Because I am a peer-reviewed journal article academic writer, and that's what I have done my entire academic history, and so I never really imagined myself writing a book. And
Really,
never, ever. And Katie came to me a few years ago and said, you know, University of California Press has this new series on communication and activism. Should we write a proposal? And I was like, but I said yes, and here we are.
That's Love crazy. It. I actually didn't know that, but you should totally be writing books all the time.
Well, now I want to write another one, but I never thought I would.
But that's a weirdo. Oh, you should explain. That's a weirdo thing of academia, right? Where they're not so interested in popular potentially popular academic books.
But you know the weird thing. I mean, I'm going to yes and Lauren. Story, which I had not heard until then. Some academics don't enjoy writing, but Lauren is a really beautiful writer, so I'm really surprised that you wouldn't
want to
write a book.
Yeah, but you get stuck in this rut. I mean, we get rewarded for writing peer-reviewed journal articles that nobody reads.
Yes.
And they're very formulaic in their structure, and this was so liberating to write because you can really develop your voice, and it's fun, and I want to do more of it, but I would not have done it if you had not asked.
Wow. Oh, my God. Well, we loved writing this book.
Good. What's your yes and story?
Well, I am a famously long-winded person, so I'm going to try to tell this in a bite-sized... How much time do we have? I'll tell it short. Tell it quick. So, I guess this is in the spirit of yes and. Mm-hmm. So, I was in Los Angeles, and I was working for a think tank that Norman Lear donated the money for, right? So it's called the Lear Center at the University of Southern California. And so I was, you know, doing research. And my boss at the time, it's a much longer story, Marty Kaplan said, you know, I was not going to meet Norman Lear. He's just like the guy that donated the money and put his name on the thing. You know, like you're not going to meet the person. Mm-hmm. So Marty said, you know, Norman Lear has purchased the Declaration of Independence. Look this up. It's a much longer story. There were 200 printed on the night of 1776, not one. Anyway, and he bought one and he wants to create.
Don't just slide by that.
I know. It's the crazy.
There were 200.
Okay, let me just quickly do it.
Yeah, do that.
On the night of July 4th, 1776, the night we declared revolution, there were 200 what's called the Dunlap broadsides of the Declaration of Independence that were produced at 3rd and Market Street. Lauren and I both went to grad school in Philly, and now it's a bar, which is sad.
Love it. No, that's great.
It's a little sad. You can get a great martini. So 200 of these things were printed, and they're not very pretty, and they're broadsheet. Oh, you all, on the podcast, you can't see my hands, but I'm making a newspaper page. And so it's a very exciting story. Those were rushed by horseback throughout the colonies. It was literally the declaration of war. He said, we're going to war. And so that's how the revolution began. So we don't think of it that way because the Declaration of Independence that's in the archives is the beautiful signed one, and they didn't sign the original because they knew they were all going to be hanged.
Yeah.
So anyway, this Dunlap broadside is the original Declaration of Independence. So over the years, many, many were lost. You know, we had a war, then we had a civil war. They were lost to the war, and people burned them or whatever. And during the Civil War, people would hide them behind paintings.
Sure.
And so, you know, over the years, like sometimes you would find one. So in 2001, the 25th known existing Dunlap broadside was found in the back of a painting at a flea market. And it was authenticated at Sotheby's. And Norman Lear, as you do, decided to buy it for $8 million. So he bought it for
$8 million?
Yeah, he just bought it. So he bought this Declaration of Independence. And he said, you know, I want to travel this document to people who will never go to, who will never be able to go to Washington. And I want to teach, you know, inspire people to be reinvigorated in their democracy through America's birth certificate, right? Okay, back to the story. So my boss says, Norman Lear bought the Declaration of Independence and he wants to create a traveling show around it. I was a very know-it-all 25-year-old fresh out of graduate school, and I was like, I know exactly what he should do with that. I want to write a research brief to tell him what to do with the thing. So I write this research brief with all these plans, and it was for my boss to take it to, mm-hmm. to Norman. And at the last minute, Marty said, I can't go to the office. Just drop it off with his assistant, and that'll be fine. So I show up at Norman's office, and I don't know what came over me, but it was a real moment of moxie. So I show up at the door, and his assistant is really kind. Maybe this is what happened. She was very kind, and I took advantage of it. So she said, oh, yes, we've been waiting for this research. Let me just take it into Mr. Lear. And I said, I'm supposed to be in that meeting, so I should just go in that meeting. So then she said, oh, well, we didn't know that because it wasn't true.
Yeah.
So I went into the meeting, and I met Norman, and then we just loved each other right away. And it was mm-hmm. like 3 hours later, you know, we're talking about civic engagement, what to do with this thing. And I was like, you might want to read my research, which is really funny now mm-hmm. when I think about it. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, he sent me a handwritten note and said, I'd like you to come work for me. And so that's how I started working for Norman Lear.
And Marty Kaplan was pissed.
You know what? Everybody shared for it. It was fine. He was making Norman happy. So that was a yes and moment, and it changed my life because, beyond the obvious, you'd think like, oh, you worked with a fancy famous smart person. But Norman's spirit was just what I needed at mm-hmm. that time because I, you know, like didn't exactly fit as like a, you know, I was a, like a little bit of a wacky smart person who wanted to be a little bit deviant.
That hasn't changed, by the way.
Yeah, that's great. And so Norman is a very fun, deep mm-hmm. soul. And mm-hmm. so I found my person.
That is a great yes and story, and also the plot of a Nicolas Cage movie.
Great.
I think we've all learned something today. The book.
Say yes.
The book is called A Comedian and an Activist Walk into a Bar: The Serious Role of Comedy in Social Justice. Katie and Lauren, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. This was such a delight.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.